Hey everybody, welcome to Two Out the First. Great to have you here today. We got plenty to talk about on today's show. In the rundown today, we're going to talk about a great article from Shane Ryan at Golf Digest trying to compare the President's Cup to the Ryder Cup and insinuating that the President's Cup is maybe already and could someday be better than the Ryder Cup. I'm going to talk about that. I think it's an interesting case, a worthwhile argument to have. And then we got the ratings for the LIV Golf Dallas Team Championship event. We also got ratings for the LPGA in Cincinnati and the DP World Tour Championship, or DP World Tour's BMW PGA Championship in England. So we're going to talk about that. And then I want to spend a couple minutes at the end of the show with a heartfelt tribute to my high school golf coach, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. First, let's start with this argument that the President's Cup is better than the Ryder Cup. And it was a great piece from Shane Ryan over at Golf Digest. If you want to take a look at it, I love Shane's writing. He really always comes up with something thought-provoking and interesting, and he's done so much bang-up stuff this year, not just about professional golf, but otherwise. It's really worth your time reading anything that he writes. And he tries to make this argument based off of one that he made last year at the Ryder Cup, that the President's Cup in 20 years from now, so in 2044, is going to be thought of as a better event than the Ryder Cup. And the basis of that argument comes from last year in the Ryder Cup in Italy, in Rome, in that Ryder Cup, like the last several before it, were basically blowouts, were over before they started, that the other side really never had a chance going back really to 2012. That was the last genuinely close Ryder Cup, and that was the miracle at Medina, and were it not for the total team malfeasance of the U.S. side on that Sunday, that one wouldn't have been close either. It would have gone back to 2010, and Hunter Mahan's unfortunate screw-up that cost the Americans a chance to win the Ryder Cup overseas for the first time since 1993. So Shane's thesis is that the Ryder Cup is not interesting. It's fun. It's a great watch in terms of the drama between the two sides. We had Hatgate last time. We had Rory McIlroy yelling at Bones in the parking lot. We had all kinds of interesting stuff that happened at that last Ryder Cup. But the golf itself was not particularly compelling, except for that, if you're an American fan, 30-minute window where you thought maybe, just maybe, if they ran the gauntlet and everything went right, they might be able to steal this one. And then Ricky plunked it in the water. Tommy Fleetwood got it onto the green. It was a concession, and the thing was suddenly over. So that's the basis upon which Shane's trying to make the case the President's Cup is maybe today and will someday be better than the Ryder Cup. And I think Shane's argument is that the matches themselves in the President's Cup last couple of times around have been closer. Now, I think my counterargument to that would be 2017, right? Liberty National, 7 years ago in New Jersey, the Cup was basically over on Saturday and could have been over on Saturday had one more match gone the Americans' way. It was that far apart from those two sides. But to the credit of Ernie Els and then Nick Price and then Trevor Immelman, really Price and Immelman, they have put a lot of time and effort into trying to build up the internationals, trying to build up what it means to be an international team member, to give the guys that are making these teams the hope that they actually might win and could be competitive. And if you look at the last several matches, certainly in 2019, the Americans got everything they asked for down at Royal Melbourne, where the internationals carried the lead into the final day, which was not something I think anyone really expected. Took a great final Sunday from the American side, including playing captain Tiger Woods, to be able to win the President's Cup that time around. And that was the site of the only United States loss in the history of these matches that go back to 1994. So in 1998, they had their first away match at Royal Melbourne. They lost then, and it felt kind of like a depleted team that week. Just everything was kind of off, and the Americans lost. There was a tie in 2003. At Fancourt in South Africa, where they had that playoff between Els and Woods, and that didn't net anything, so they agreed to do it as a tie. That could have been decided differently if they didn't feel the same about the rules between Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus, who were the captains that time. So, you know, over the history of it, you can't really argue that the President's Cup has been more competitive. It hasn't been. But in more recent times, it certainly has been. And because there is a little bit more neutrality, I think, in terms of setup that you get from the PGA Tour, there isn't a dramatic advantage one way or the other. The course isn't picked and set up so that one side, the host side, has a dramatic edge over the other. The thing that the Europeans did so well in picking the Italian host course venue was they decided that they wanted to put mid and longer irons in the Americans' hands, take the wedges out of their hands, and force them into shots that made them uncomfortable that they don't hit week to week on the PGA Tour. That succeeded. Then the Americans took the opposite approach last time around in Wisconsin, right? They set up Whistling Straits so that their best hitters could drive greens and put themselves in positions where they had wedges and short game shots, and that the power had all the edge. And they blew out the Europeans because they didn't have the same amount of power, and they didn't have the same kind of style that allowed them to overwhelm Whistling Straits, right? So you pick the golf courses almost in such a way that you know the outcome's going to happen before it happens. And oh, by the way, winning on the road is extremely difficult. So you would expect in 2025 at the Ryder Cup at Bethpage that Bethpage Black's going to be set up to favor the Americans and their length. They're going to shorten a number of tees, even though it's a brute of a course. They're going to open up hole locations that favor the Americans. They're going to try to do it in a way so the Americans are practically assured that they're going to win. And in that sense, I think Shane's got a point that it's kind of dull. But you also have to kind of have something turn the other way. You have to have that moment in time when the competition changes. And for the Ryder Cup, that was 1979, bringing in continental Europe. That was coming over here and winning at Muirfield. That was and taking one to the Americans on American soil. That was the War on the Shore. That was in 91. Having those kind of seminal moments in genuine competition where it feels like the outcome is in doubt and there's a, not maybe bad blood. I don't think you can really have bad blood amongst a ton of millionaire golfers, but to have some kind of legitimate rivalry and something to play for, something to care about, something to argue over, something to galvanize the other side. And I know Jim Furyk is very anti-Americans rooting against the American side. I mean, he told Adam Shupak from Golf Week to go F himself, because Adam insinuated that the internationals winning would be a better story, which it would be, than the Americans winning this week because of the amount of time and effort that goes into it. I understand Furyk's argument. But in terms of the grand scheme of things, an international win this week, and even if it doesn't happen this week, could happen the next time in 2026, could happen in 2028. Eventually, it's going to happen because the gap is much, much, much shorter. Right now, the Americans also have by far the two best players on the planet, in Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele. And that's kind of hard to beat. But in a team situation where you have 10 other guys on the team and the format does not allow you as easily to hide your worst players like you can in the Ryder Cup, you may have a chance to overcome those two guys being on separate twosomes in the twosomes matches at being able to play as many sessions as they need to play, right? I think this could be pretty interesting this week. And if the internationals find a way to win, which again, the odds market says is very unlikely, then you've got that galvanizing moment. You've got that thing. The best thing that they've got happened on this golf course in 2007, 17 years ago, when Mike Weir beat Tiger Woods one-on-one in Sunday. And that was a big deal in Canada at the time. Didn't turn out to really mean anything in the competition, but that moment, that's like the international reel of like, the coolest thing to happen to them other than 98 and 03. So if you can have another moment like that this week, if you have a winning moment for that side, I think that's better for the series in the long haul. Also, international golf is increasingly on par with what you see in this country, with what you see among the European players. It's just different. And you have players that could be eligible for this, especially as Tristan Lawrence becomes a DP or goes from being a DP World Tour member to being a PGA Tour member next year. He'll surely be in the top 10, then move on to the PGA Tour from the DP World Tour. There are going to be other players like that. You're going to have this up and coming movement of players who are going to come into their own and maybe they do something with this. So I don't think that presently speaking, the President's Cup is better than the Ryder Cup. I like the format more. I like the 4-day thing. I like having one session days of five matches, five foursomes, and five four balls. You can't hide. It's hard to hide in this format. You got to send out 10 guys in each of those days. You can put two on the bench, and everyone's got to play. And you can't just hide them until Sunday. You can't do that. So then you have that Saturday session of eight matches, which is really interesting. You have more points, more opportunity. it can work. I do like that format better, but need to see some action go the other way. We need to see some international victories to kind of get to that outcome that I think Shane can rightly suggest is possible. Just not, I don't see it quite yet. All right, let's talk a little bit about the ratings from the weekend that was in golf. Heard from Josh Carpenter and Sports TV ratings. I saw a very funny tweet related to political polls today. I'm a bit of a political junkie. People live here in the D.C. area, as you might imagine, that's possible. And someone shared some new polling data from, I don't know, Battleground State or something. And the person tweeted, like, "All right, you piggies, here's your morning slop straight from the trough." And that's kind of why I feel like on Tuesday mornings now with television ratings, then you're trying to compare PGA Tour versus LIV or just see what the PGA Tour does against itself or anything like that. Obviously, didn't have the PGA Tour this week. They were off. President's Cup this week. Sanderson Farms next week. They'll have an event to compare against again. So LIV had no competition, right? At least in terms of men's stateside professional golf. They had the BMW PGA Championship. That went first. That was earliest in the day. That was on Golf Channel on Sunday. About 120-ish thousand people watched it, which for a DP World Tour event in the fall on a football Sunday is pretty good. I think that's a pretty solid number. I don't get worldwide figures. I don't know how many people watched on Sky, for example, or anything like that. I don't know those numbers, but that's just an American number on TV, on Golf Channel. The LPGA picked up a little bit more than that, closer to 130,000 in the Cincinnati area for Lydia Ko to win once again on their schedule, won the Kroger Queen City Championship out at TPC Riversbend. She went up winning by five. She was down by two to start the day. Eventually, it kind of turns into a blowout, and you probably lose some people. So maybe if it were closer, it's closer to 145,000, 150,000 people on the average in the end. LIV, we got data from Sports TV ratings and Josh Carpenter for Saturday and Sunday. Same pattern applied to LIV Golf as it did for their Chicago event, which was that their Saturday audience was significantly higher than their Sunday audience. But the overall audience for this was better. It was something like 179,000 people on TV on the CW on Saturday on average. On Sunday, that rating dropped by about 50,000 to about 129,000 people. So that number is significantly better than the team championship, or excuse me, the individual championship event. As I mentioned in yesterday's show, I think LIV Golf kind of missed the mark a long time ago in not emphasizing the team portion of this. That's what makes LIV unique. That's what makes it somewhat different in an appealing way to people who are more traditional golf fans. That could have been the hook. That could have been the thing. But it isn't, and it hasn't been. And that has caused an issue over the years. And we're done through season three. I know this is year three as well of LIV Golf. They'll tell you it's their second year because of the second LIV Golf League season. But I don't expect to see massive changes from LIV going into next year. Maybe the number of spots available through the promotions event, whether they do that at all or how they do it, that could change. You're not going to see, I don't think, a drastic difference. You're not going to see a change from 14 events to 18 or 12 or 10. They're going to keep those. They're going to keep it as an international focus. There's going to be more international events than American events. They're going to take the gamble that the international audience will kind of barnacle themselves to this product in a different way than Americans perhaps have. The interesting thing to me in terms of contrast, not just in ratings, but also in-person experience, if you look at the number of people that went to the LIV Golf Chicago event at Bolingbrook, the crowds in person were quite good for LIV. I mean, 12, 13, 15,000 people a day. They said they sold out. It doesn't matter whether it's sell or not. It's how many people are there. And 15,000 is a substantial number of people. And it looked like there were a lot of people there. Whether they were there to take in the golf, whether they were there to take in a concert, whether they were there to drink or just get out or have fun or worry that the Bears are going to be bad, I don't know. But the in-person crowds looked a whole lot better in Chicago than they did in Dallas, where it was sweltering hot, 92 degrees. By the end, it looked like there might have been a couple thousand people around the green to watch the Ripper team wind up winning the championship. I think, and I know we talk about TV ratings, but TV ratings are also influenced by how many people are there in person and how much it looks like they're having fun. And I am kind of surprised that more people didn't watch the Chicago one because it looked like the people there were having a better time and there were more of them than in Dallas where, like I said, it was extremely hot. It sounds like they didn't do the best internal promotion for the city And by the end, it didn't look like anyone particularly was worried about the outcome except the players, their wives, and the people that work on the teams. So sometimes TV ratings just don't make sense. Maybe that 89,000 number is a huge outlier or a significant outlier for Liv over in the grand scheme of things. Same thing with that 69,000 number on Golf Channel for the Pro Corps. I don't think people even knew it was happening, and the people that did knew it was a blowout on Sunday. So I think Sanderson Farms will help us kind of reset that a little bit, get a better sense of what the audience is for the fall on the PGA Tour. But I think the big takeaway from all of this is football is king, especially professional football. And if you're trying to compete against it, you're going to get stomped, especially in a world where cable subscriptions are going down and there are just fewer people who have pay TV to watch stuff like the LPGA Tour and the DP World Tour on the weekend. And if you're not streaming it through Peacock or your streaming service that lets you access Golf Channel through that subscription, it's increasingly difficult to gather an audience on cable around golf. Just to keep that in mind. All right, I'd like to spend a couple of minutes at the end of the show today dedicated to the memory of Mike Dooley, who was my golf coach in high school. I went to Mount St. Joseph High School near Baltimore City. I'm a guy who grew up near Baltimore. My parents still live in the house that we moved into in 1993. And I went to St. Joe because a lot of my friends from my K-8 school went there, and they were my best friends. And I went there, fell in love with the place, fell in love with the environments and all boys school. And I had just started taking up the game a couple of years earlier in life. And I figured out how to break 100. I'd figured out how to break 90, could shoot in the mid-80s. And I tried out for our golf team in 1997 as a freshman. There were maybe one, two spots available for the team. And miraculously, I got on the team. I shot 43 or 44 the first day. Second day, everything went right. I didn't feel as nervous. I made putts for par, easily two-putted, made a birdie. And I came to the last hole to that Rolling Road Golf Club. If you've ever seen in the D.C. area, it's an incredible place on 99 acres of land. And it's a short par four to finish the nine, plays a little uphill. And back in the day, there used to be a tree that overhanged over the green. And there were a bunch of the team members that were already there were underneath that tree. My coach, Mike Dooley, was under the tree. And I hit this scald wedge from the middle of the fairway. And it was terrifying. In that moment, I thought for sure I'd blown my chance because it was getting ready to go past the tree, past the practice green, into the parking lot, hit a car. I was so worried that I had ruined everything that I had done that day. And fortunately, it hit a tree, that tree, and caromed softly down onto the green below, about 7 feet away. Now, sarcastic applause from the kids who were watching, and I nervously made it. It was the first time in my life I'd ever broken 40 for nine holes. And Mike Dooley invited me to be on his team. And I was on the varsity golf team for 4 years. Mike Dooley passed away over the weekend unexpectedly, shocked our community, shocked our golf community, shocked our school community. And I wanted to pay him tribute, and I wrote an article over at golfnewsnet.com about him, because while I really appreciated him as a golf coach in high school, I appreciated him so much more once I became a coach myself. And now that I'm living life as an adult with multiple kids and a full-time job, and all of the effort that Mike Dooley put into being a coach for hundreds of kids. He was our coach for 32 years at Mount St. Joe. And through that time, he saw all the ups and downs. He managed everything. He made sure we had a place to play almost every day during our season on weekdays. We had nine hole rounds at Rolling Road. If we couldn't play at Rolling Road, we went to a driving range, and we got help from the PGA pro who was working at the driving range, helped us out a little bit. We went to rules seminars that he got us into with the club so that we could learn the rules and be better stewards of the game. He worked tirelessly with us. He made sure we had rides and logistics and golf balls and everything that we needed to be successful. And he did all of that for free. He wasn't paid. He had a full-time job. He had other stuff to do. But he did it because he loved Mount St. Joe. He was a 1966 graduate of the school. And he was so actively involved in our alumni community. He was a member of our alumni board. And he just gave so selflessly of himself to so many people, many people who understand it and appreciate it, and many who probably have never understood it and never realized it. And he gave so selflessly of his time and of himself, and he worked and everything that he did with love behind it because he wanted his school community that he fell in love with so many years ago to be just as great in the present as it was when he was an active student. And I could not be more proud to have played for him. He was always so encouraging, especially after I got out of Mount St. Joe. He was kind of a little more stern when I played for him, probably because I didn't listen to some of his advice about course management and didn't always play my best in the winter seasons. But he was so encouraging after I got out of school, particularly as I got married and started a family, and we kept up on social media, and I'd go to the occasional MSJ event, or he would leave me a note in a comment section, an article I wrote, or a personal update, always being so encouraging about my personal and professional life. And a couple of years ago, I got to speak at my school, and I do each year to our school's journalism class. One of my best friends from Mount St. Joe, Ed Schulteis, is the guy who runs that class, and he also is the assistant golf coach, and he took up that mantle a few years ago. And so after I spoke to his journalism class, he asked me if I wanted to go over to Rolling Road, see golf practice. Could not wait. Loved it. I mean, so many memories from just that 10-minute drive from Mount St. Joe to Rolling Road. And Mike Dooley was there and could not have been more gregarious. It was so exciting to get to talk to him, to get to catch up with him. And he was so excited to talk to me, to show me around. Rolling Road had done an incredible renovation. To see that, to see the kids who are now on the team and what their swings look like and their talent level, and just to kind of talk about life. And there needs to be more guys like Mike Dooley in the world. And the world is less off today because there's one less Mike Dooley. And there needs to be more people who are willing to step up without showing off and commit to service and love in everything that they do. And we would be so much better off as a people if we all did that for one another. And fortunately, I had that example in my high school golf coach, Mike Dooley. So rest in peace, Mike. God bless your family. Thank you for everything. That's going to do it for us today on the show. Thank you so much for spending some time with me. I appreciate it. I'm back with another show tomorrow. We'll have plenty to talk about between the Open de España, the LPGA being in Northwest Arkansas, as well as the President's Cup. If you want to get a hold of me, I'm on social media at Ryan Ballingy, or Golf News Net's on social media at the handle Golf News Net. Thank you so much for watching. We will talk to you tomorrow on Two Off the First.